our left is Herbert B. Livingston, president of Atheists United, an organization that has two primary purposes: to defend the separation of church and state as provided in the U.S. Constitution, and two, to educate the people about atheism. After a number of years as a successful writer of science fiction and other short stories, Mr. Livingston became a businessman. Presently, he is a semi-retired insurance executive. To my immediate left is Dr. John Warwick Montgomery, dean of the Simon Greenleaf School of Law, a law school that incorporates Christian theology, human rights, and an eternal perspective on the law, as well as practical legal training. Dr. Montgomery is a member of the Bar of the Commonwealth of Virginia and of the State of California. Holds 7 earned degrees besides the LLB, the AB with Distinction in Philosophy, Cornell University, Pi Beta Kappa, BLS and MA, University of California at Berkeley, BD and STM, Wittenberg University, Springfield, Ohio, PhD, University of Chicago, and the Doctor d'Université from Strasbourg, France. He is the author of over 100 scholarly journal articles and more than 30 books. He is honored by inclusion in Who's Who in America, Who's Who in American Law, Who's Who in France, Who's Who in Europe, and Who's Who in the World. the Directory of American Scholars, and he is the International Scholars Directory Editor and Chief. In spite of these credentials, he's particularly appreciated for his lively and dynamic teaching style. Dr. David P. Hunt in the center here, Assistant Professor of Philosophy, will be the moderator. Dr. Hunt earned his Bachelor of Arts degree from Pomona College, his MA, and recently completed PhD from Vanderbilt University. The title of his thesis is Ontological Kinds in the Area of Metaphysics. Dr. Hunt teaches classes including History of Philosophy, Metaphysics, and Social Philosophy. With no further ado, let us begin.
It has been said that we live in a post-Christian culture. Of course, the actual situation is quite a bit more complicated than this would suggest. Polls show that 80 to 90% of Americans profess belief in the existence of a supreme being. Whatever factors led to the secularization of our culture, and I'll leave it to the historians to identify what they are, it's not my competency, belief in God seems to have remained relatively intact, if less orthodox. The existence of God seems to be one of those eternal questions which will always be with us. In his great novel, The Brothers Karamazov, Dostoevsky has two brothers, Ivan and Alyosha, meet in a tavern for one of the most profound discussions of ideas in literary history. Near the beginning of their conversation, Ivan asks what other boys, like themselves, might talk about at such a time. And he answers his own question. Of the eternal questions, of the existence of God and immortality, and those who do not believe in God talk of socialism or anarchism, of the transformation of all humanity on a new pattern, so that it all comes to the same. They're the same questions turned inside out. And masses of the most original Russian boys do nothing but talk of the eternal questions. Isn't it so? And Alyosha, his brother, then replies, yes. For real Russians, the questions of God's existence and of immortality, or, as you say, the same questions turned inside out, come first and foremost, of course, and so they should. I think that the reason that this passage from the novel has always particularly appealed to me is that I'm a teacher of philosophy, and Dostoevsky's description of college-age boys actually getting together of their own free will to discuss philosophical questions makes me feel a bit wistful. Marx, of course, dismissed the existence of God as a topic of serious discussion with the famous phrase, "Religion is the opiate of the masses," while Freud held that religious beliefs are a sign of immaturity. But two can play the ad hominem game, and it was left to the French philosopher Raymond Aron, who died just 3 or 4 weeks ago, to deliver the classic reply to Marx when he said, "Revolution is the opiate of the intellectuals." Dostoevsky, on the other hand, seems to be suggesting that religion and revolution, God and utopia, are both fit subjects for discussion, even among intellectuals, such as we all are here tonight. Evidently, we agree with Dostoevsky on this point. our two speakers and you, the audience, whatever our differences of opinion on how these questions should be answered, are evidently in agreement that these questions are important, since we've all taken the trouble to come here tonight rather than staying home and watching Real People or The Fall Guy. Now that you know what's on TV tonight, I hope there isn't a mad rush for the exits. I don't know if we determined who was going to begin here tonight. Should we flip a coin?
Flip.
Okay. Do you want to call? Heads. Your choice.
My opponent may begin.
Thank you.
Mr. Livingston will begin, and each of our speakers will have 20 minutes in which to make the presentation, and there will be a 5 or roughly around that time limit opportunity for each to respond to the others after they've both made their initial presentation. Then we'll open discussion up to the floor.
Thank you. After hearing Dr. Montgomery's qualifications, I feel almost as though I'm debating a minor deity. And by the way, since Dr. Hunt has mentioned, since Dr. Hunt has mentioned Dostoevsky's novel Brothers Karamazov, I suggest that you get a copy of it, which contains the chapter called The Grand Inquisitor, which is the story of the Grand Inquisitor and his men suddenly seeing someone raising someone from the dead and realizing that the Savior was Jesus Christ, and so he orders him to seize Christ and bring him in, and then ensues a long dialogue in which he finally persuades Christ that it would be far better if he left the earth, because it was more important to have the church than Jesus Christ. Anyway, it's an interesting part of the book that was left out for many, many years. As to the question this evening, does God exist? It's not as simple as it sounds, because in order to determine whether anything exists, we have to know what we're talking about. We have to know what we mean by God. And of course, one way to decide what we mean by God is to look in the dictionary and get a dictionary definition. And we'll find words defined by other words, defined by other words, defined by other words. And pretty soon, we have libraries that are full of these words. And the only phrase I can think of in trying to deal with them, it's like trying to shovel smoke. So I propose that in order to handle the subject at all in such a short time as we have, that we dispense with definitions and try another approach that will focus us a little more closely on what we mean by God. I'd like to make a little survey first. Are there any Muslims in the audience? Any Buddhists? Any believers in Hinduism? Well, that's interesting, because over 1 billion people are believers in those faiths, and yet in this audience of hundreds, not one person has ever been electrified by the realization that there is no God but Allah and Muhammad is his prophet. And none of you have ever had the sudden notion to run up a bumper sticker that said Krishna is Lord and put it on your car. Or awakened one morning with the realization that Buddha is the way and the life and the truth. I imagine there are also no Taoists or Shintoists or Zoroastrians, and that none of you believe in the gods of the Mayans or the Aztecs are the gods of the ancient Egyptians, Amun-Ra, or Osiris, or Isis, or Horus, or the gods of the ancient Greeks, Zeus, Dionysus, Bacchus, any of those? How about the Norse gods, Wotan, Freya, Loki? None of those. Well, that's interesting. I imagine there are also no druids. None of you believe that there are spirits residing in trees. Well, we've done two things, one of which is we've kind of narrowed the field down to what kind of God we might be talking about here. And also, by the way, as an aside, we've established something. We've proved that there is such a thing as an atheist, despite what many people will tell you, in regard to all the gods who've been mentioned. You are all atheists. None of you believe in them, any of them. Although millions of people have, billions have, you're not agnostic on the subject. You do not think that there is even a possibility. Not only that there's not any evidence in favor of them existing, but that they absolutely couldn't exist. So we can proceed on to what we're really talking about here and what I think most of us mean, which is the God of the Bible. Does that God exist? Well, of course, we have to think, too, about what do we mean by exist. I mean, if I said this table exists, or you exist, or I exist, it would be pretty obvious. Generally, when we say something exists, we mean it occupies space and time. And that it is perceivable to our senses. To at least one of them. We can see it, touch it, smell it, hear it, and through our senses that we would be able to reason about it, comprehend it in some way. A perceivable God might be very godlike, could have almost limitless power, or even appear to us to have limitless power. Suppose a spaceship were to land here on Earth and disgorge some creatures who were so far advanced above us in science, in ability, that the things they did would seem absolutely impossible to us, that they could only be accomplished by a god. But I don't think we would call them gods. So that God is not perceivable. And usually God is described, at least the one we're talking about, as being supernatural, not available to our senses, as being transcendent, beyond the reach of our senses, even beyond the reach of our reason. That poses kind of a problem, because it's pretty hard for human beings to deal with a God like that. They can't see him, hear him. There's no way they can even think of him, usually. And that, of course, is a problem which is solved in the New Testament, because in the New Testament we have God incarnate. God has given us a Son in the flesh, so that his promise is fulfilled. We know God. His Son Jesus lived as a human being, was born as a human being, suffered, performed miracles so that the people then would know that he was God, or at least God-like, and then died and was resurrected and reunited with God. Of course, couldn't let him stay dead. That would be too human. So he was resurrected and reunited with God, Father and Son. together in one. Of course, some Christians also have a third party, the Holy Ghost, and that creates kind of an interesting mathematics. A Father, a Son, a Holy Ghost, 1 + 1 + 1 = 1. Take away 1 from 3, you have 1. Take away 2 from 3, you have 1. Always comes out 1. Well, that solves the problem, of course, of this invisible, supernatural, transcendent God. And it's a pretty good scenario, it would seem to us. It must have been good. It played for thousands of years in Egypt. Osiris was the son of God. You said you didn't believe in him. He was born as a human. He lived, he suffered, he died, he was resurrected to be the judge of the dead and the guardian of the living. It went over so well, it played in India. Krishna was the son of the god Vishnu, born as a human being, lived, died, and was resurrected. In Greece, they ran the same program with someone named Dionysius. Didn't go over so well in Jerusalem. They had to take it out of town. The people who were around then and saw the miracles apparently were not too impressed by it. So why should we believe this version of the story? Well, of course, we have the Bible. Of course, the Hindus have the Vedas. And the Egyptians have the Book of the Dead. Everybody has a book. There are, of course, great authorities that we can quote on the subject. The Greeks, of course, could quote Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, Pythagoras. I'm sure many of you, all of you, have heard of them. Not inferior in any way in the mentality of any of our philosophers or professors or teachers. And as far as that goes, the Egyptians were no slouches either. Anybody who has been to Egypt and seen the wonders that they built, the Temple of Karnak, the pyramids, Abu Simbel, must be struck by the enormous intelligence of those people, and they all believe the story of Osiris. I've been there, and near Luxor in the Valley of the Queens, I have seen the story on the wall of the temple of Queen Hatshepsut, who lived long before the alleged time of Jesus Christ. And I have seen that story in words and pictures. Here is the god placing the baby in the womb of a mother, a mortal woman, the baby being born, living, reigning as queen, as Pharaoh of Egypt, dying, and then being reborn again as a god. So, many of us don't believe the story of Osiris or Krishna or any of the others. And there's no more reason, really, to believe the story of the Bible. No more reason to believe that that version of God is true or that that God exists. Well, the second part of this debate is the question, what difference does it make? If there's no God, what difference is it? It makes a great deal of difference, actually, for an interesting reason. Because we have a pretty good idea from the story we've been told what kind of God he would be. He would create the earth, the sun, the stars, the universe. But after all, that's God's business. I mean, that's what gods do. They create universes. But this God would not only create it, he would instantly forget the laws that he had set up to govern the universe. On the first day, make the earth, the heavens, for the evening, morning, the first day, the second day, manufacture something else, create something, trees, grasses, flowers, evening and morning, the third day, and by golly, on the fourth day, he'd suddenly realize he hadn't created the sun. But there had been evenings and mornings and days and nights, no sun. He would create people and give them brains and a desire for knowledge, make them susceptible to temptation, and then place them in a garden and put temptation before them, the fruit of the tree of knowledge, knowing that they were incapable of refusing the temptation. And after all, they were hungry for knowledge. That's what people are. That's what differentiates people from so-called lower creatures. We have brains, but for eating of the fruit, they were cursed forever. Not only they who had committed this terrible sin, which they couldn't help committing because he'd made them that way, but all their descendants into infinity, people who had never had anything to do with that sin, doomed to eternal damnation. But God doesn't like knowledge too much. That's pretty much the history of God. When people begin to get too smart, they build a Tower of Babel, and he tears it down and disperses them and causes them to have so many different tongues that they can't understand each other. As a result of which, because one word, a mistake of just a single word in translating from Russian to English could result in the end of the world, practically. We saw it after in the Second World War in Japan, when the Japanese were willing to surrender, and surrender completely, but because an interpreter misinterpreted one single word, we dropped two atomic bombs on them. We have a God, if we have a God, who believes in slavery, who chooses a people as his chosen people, then puts them into slavery, takes them out, drags them for 40 years across the miserable Sinai Desert, and anybody who's seen it knows how barren and miserable it is. And by the time they are through, for 40 years of wandering that desert, they are as mean and savage and hungry as anybody could be. And then he turns them loose in Jordan and what is now the country of Israel on a bunch of shepherds and farmers who were doing them no harm, and commits the worst atrocities we can think of. Not only sends them out to kill all the men, all the warriors, all the male children, but even the pregnant women to slice open their bellies, and even to tear the suckling babes from their mother's breast and kill them. That's the kind of God we'd have. He would withhold knowledge of himself from generation after generation of people, knowledge he could have made, he could make available. But then, because they did not know him and believe in him, he would damn them to eternal torment. A God whose idea of justice resulted in the punishment for a man who had erred to have his wife and daughters raped. It's a pretty good sentence for a fella. A God who gives us the most violent, abominable curse of all. After all, in the Old Testament, God may make people miserable. He may torment them. He may torture them. But once they're dead, he's through with them. It remains for the New Testament to give us the most vile of all things, hell eternal, no end to torment and torture. Just think of that. A God also who would allow murderers to go straight to heaven while their innocent victims are doomed to hell. Even a slaughtered child violated, slaughtered, the murderer can go to heaven, that infant, that child goes to hell. We'd have a God who enforces obedience and cooperation by bribery and extortion, promises of heaven, threats of hell, endlessly going on, a little twist of torture, and then a promise of what a loving, merciful God he is, really loves us. Why don't we go along, do what he wants, and then a little more twist. In the prison camps, they call that brainwashing. That's the technique they use. So I would say it's lucky that that God does not exist. We're very fortunate indeed. Thank you.
I'm not going to speak to the particular questions raised by my opponent until we have a chance to dialogue subsequently. I want to make a formal presentation. It'll touch on some of the points that have already been raised, but I prefer not to get into those points specifically. The fewer the better. I think that was the line in Sophists, as Socrates described them. It seems to me that we have to see that this kind of a question is really a matter of life or death. It isn't something simply for intellectual discussion here in a structured debate. If God does exist, the implications of this are staggering. If he doesn't exist, then we certainly ought to give up any naive beliefs along that line. Socrates talked about the unexamined life not being worth living. And I think it's a shame that so many people manage to get to college and they deal with almost everything else than the kind of question that's being dealt with here tonight. This issue is really crucial. Let me indicate a couple of reasons why it's crucial. Since I'm privileged to be in the presence of Littérateur this evening, let me give you a quotation from the Venerable Bede. He is not read much these days. Few people trample each other to get him at the local bookstores. But back in the 7th century, there was a competition between representatives of the Christian faith and representatives of paganism in Northumbria, in England. And the question was whether or not the king would go over to Christianity. And when the Christian missionaries presented Christianity, they presented in these terms. We have this from Bede's account. O king, this present life of men on earth, in comparison with the time that is unknown to us, seems to me as if you were sitting at a banquet with your thanes in the winter time, with the fire burning and the hall warmed, and outside the storms of winter rain or snow were raging. And then there should come a sparrow, swiftly flying through the hall, coming in by one door and flying out through another. Interestingly enough, the hall was probably very much like this. During the time it is inside, it is not touched by the storm of winter. But that little moment of quiet having passed, it soon returns from winter back to winter again and is lost to sight. So this mortal life seems like a short interval. What may have gone before or what may come after it, we do not know. Therefore, if this new teaching has brought any greater certainty, it seems fitting that it should be followed. The argument of the missionaries was that Christianity had brought greater certainty. And if there is sufficient evidence of this, if Christianity does offer a greater insight into the nature of our time here in this world and what happens to us subsequently, then surely that's every reason before facing the evidence involved in it. Concretely, I'm in the area of human rights, and I find this. Everybody's in favor of human rights. Nobody's against human rights. At the International Institute of Human Rights in Strasbourg, France, we've never found anybody who says he's against human rights. It's like apple pie, motherhood, and the flag. But a very strange thing happens when one comes down to the question of what human rights are. People define human rights in terms of their own self-interest, just as people create ethical systems in terms of their own self-interest. And this problem has gotten to the point where nations and individuals are slaughtering each other and attempting to justify it right and left. Our secular centuries since the 18th have accounted for more death and inhumanity of man toward man than at any other point in human history. When Robert Jackson summed up after Nuremberg, in connection with the war crimes trials at Nuremberg, he pointed out that the terrors of past generations paled before the atrocities of our own day. Problem is that as a result of losing any kind of absolute basis for ethics or morals, it's simply not been possible to justify absolute human value. It hasn't been possible to establish an ethic which can in any way counter this sort of thing. When Nietzsche, at the end of the 19th century, coined the phrase, God is dead, he of course had to associate it with man as a God substitute. So from the death of God, we went to the Übermensch, to the Superman. And if one individual or one nation has the power to force its values on others, then what absolute standard could possibly go against it? No absolute standards continue, and as a result of this kind of thing, we find ourselves in a position where we cannot justify human value, where we cannot justify human action, where we have no moral values on the basis of which we can survive in a period when these are particularly necessary. So, if a God exists, and if he has revealed himself to us, giving us more knowledge of eternity and more knowledge of ourselves and a value system, then surely this ought to be of the greatest consequence to us. The $64,000 question obviously is whether or not evidence exists so that we can meaningfully assert the existence of God. In a 20-minute presentation, it's not going to be possible to go into evidences in a great deal of detail, but I'm going to mention two or three lines along which it's possible to move in order to see that the existence of God is by all means more plausible than the assertion that he does not exist. Probably you have heard of the traditional proofs of the existence of God. I'm not going to bother with those particularly, but I am going to point out the root argument which lies at the basis of them. This argument is known philosophically as the contingency argument. It was presented with tremendous effectiveness by Frederick Copleston, the historian of philosophy, in his debate with Bertrand Russell on the BBC back in the 1940s. And the argument goes like this, in very simple terms. Anything you come across in the world is incapable of explaining itself. Nothing has sufficient self-explanation within it. You've got to appeal beyond anything you come across in order to be able to offer an explanation of it. Now, the world, sad to say, is the sum total of all the stuff in it. And if you take a sum total of contingencies, you do not suddenly get a self-explanatory world. What you get is a whale of a lot of contingency. And this means that when the atheist says this world is all there is, he turns out to be the greatest mythologist imaginable. He mythologically turns a contingent world into an absolute world. He never finds anything in this world that can explain itself, but suddenly the whole bloomin' thing is self-explanatory. It doesn't require any appeal beyond itself to anything. the theist, or the believer in God, whatever else is said about him, at least is realistic. He doesn't deify a world that offers no evidence for its own deification. Illustrations of the contingency principle are found in contemporary science. For example, the second law of thermodynamics simply applies this kind of reasoning in the area of energy. The availability of energy will decline in a finite period of time. Now, if the universe really had been around forever, then of course it would have had more than enough time to reach heat death. The fact that we've got enough energy to conduct this debate tonight is a pretty good indication that that hasn't occurred, and therefore there's something the matter with the assumptions here. As the authors of one of the most basic thermodynamics texts that we have, published by John Wiley, the authors chiefly Gordon Van Wylen of the University of Michigan, have said, the second law of thermodynamics simply forces us to the view that the universe is finite. It is not an infinite universe. In 1823, Friedrich Elbers, the German astronomer, developed what he called Elbers' paradox. Referring to stellar phenomena. It would appear that if the universe were infinite, with the stars present throughout it, that we would not have the dark sky at night. What we would have is the sky at night with infinite light reflected from those infinite stellar phenomena. Elbers' paradox is another indication that we are dealing with a finite universe and not an infinite one. I refer you to Jockey's work, The Paradox of Elbers' Paradox, on the subject. Again, people have not killed each other to get this at their local bookstores, but it is a vital illustration of the contingency principle. Even Isaac Asimov, of all people, in his recent popular work on astronomy, simply takes it for granted that the universe is finite. He even suggests its radius, the radius of the finite universe. I think he's off by 3 miles myself, but the point is that he is setting forth a finite view of the universe, not an infinite one. By definition, when you begin talking about a finite universe, you're going to be asserting something that is non-universe above and beyond it. In the case of the second law of thermodynamics, we have a divine gas station attendant who is feeding energy in, apparently, or at least a divine creator who started the whole thing off at the outset. But apart from those arguments, it seems to me that we would accomplish the most if we focused in on the claims made that God became man, that God entered this world in Jesus Christ. I'm delighted that Mr. Levingston sees the significance of getting onto this subject, because if the historical data are sound relative to the person of Jesus Christ, then we have here something qualitatively different from the Osirises, the Krishnas, the Dionysi of history. You see, it's one thing to have similar religious claims. It's a totally different thing to have religious claims that are backed up by a historical and factual resurrection. We don't want to commit a post hoc, propter hoc fallacy here. We don't want to get the idea that simply because there have been similar religious claims throughout history, that somehow removes from the validity of any one of them. That will have to be checked out in terms of the specific evidences. And what do we have concretely? We have primary source material relative to the personality and character of Jesus Christ. Sir Frederick Kenyon of the British Museum, one of the foremost textual critics of this 20th century, has stated that the documentary evidence for Jesus Christ is the best documentary evidence of the ancient world. Why? Because of the tremendous number of good manuscripts relative to that material, to the papyrus fragments and quotations that go back right on top of the first century itself. We have fragments of the Gospel of John within 5 years of the writing of the Gospel. These documents were in circulation while hostile witnesses were alive and who would have had, to use a lawyer's expression, means, motive, and opportunity to refute what was said about Jesus Christ if that material had been false. They were chiefly Jewish religious leaders. They had every reason to refute those claims if the claims had not been sound. Within these claims are the fulfillments of over 25 detailed and specific Old Testament prophecies. A mathematician some years ago calculated the probabilities against 25 such prophecies being fulfilled in a single person, using a factor for the probability of each one as 1 to 4. And that isn't bad. I mean, actually, the probability of a person being born of a virgin, I think, is considerably less than 1 to 4. And calculating this out, he came to the following result. This is on the formula P to the N equals 1 over 4 to the N, where N equals 25. There is one chance out of 1,000 trillion that those 25 prophecies would have come out in reference to one particular person. Can you imagine that the Jewish religious leaders of Jesus' time would not have pointed out how the writers had been fudging this stuff, or that the apostles had been faking it, if that had not actually been the case? Some years ago, a lawyer by the name of Frank Morrison decided that he would polish off the evidence for God's existence in Jesus Christ once and for all by going after the resurrection. He recognizes, Mr. Levingston does, that that is a key point. He spent 2 years researching a book on the subject, and he wrote the book. It's entitled, Who Moved the Stone? Just one unfortunate thing happened. In the course of doing the historical research, Morrison became a Christian. He became a Christian because of the overwhelming evidence that this man, as a matter of fact, was more than a man, rose again from the dead. There's a story told at the time of the French Revolution, and I'll conclude with it. It's a story concerning a little-known deistic philosopher that time by the name of La Verdelière. It's a true story. La Verdelière decided that he would start a new religion. That was the habit of the time. And he set forth a set of doctrines and ideology and tracts and a social program and the rest of it. And it just didn't take. And he was very discouraged. So he presented this to his fellow philosophers, including Talleyrand, the French philosopher Talleyrand. I'm sure you've heard of him. And when Talleyrand heard this, he said to La Verdelière, "My dear fellow, it seems to me that Jesus Christ, in order to found his religion, died and rose again on the third day. You could at least do that much." And at that particular point, we see the qualitative distinction between the religious claims of history and an instance where, according to the person who went through it himself and according to those who observed what he went through, God became man. If that actually took place, then the claims of that individual on your life and my life are more important than any other single thing that you will ever come across in your existence. What we need to do, each of us, is to have the intellectual courage to check out that evidence. We must not go on the basis of vague literary analogy or generalities. We must get down to the specifics of this evidence and see if the evidence actually holds water. If it does, then eternity depends upon it, and we better be sure that we are aligned with it. Thank you.
Our two speakers have been very good to stay well within the time limit set for them. Mr. Livingston now has 5, 7, 8 minutes around there to deliver a response.
Well, of course, the first point made by Dr. Montgomery was that things cannot hold within themselves an explanation for themselves, that the world as a whole, the universe as a whole, cannot have an explanation for itself. There must be an outside explanation that will tell us the reason why all this is here, and will explain it all. I don't know why it is necessarily so, even if you could prove that something did not contain within itself an explanation, that something outside itself would necessarily have an explanation. You know, the universe is not an automobile. We can ask for the reason why an automobile exists. It's to furnish us with transportation, faster transportation than a horse and buggy, etc., etc. Why does the universe exist? Well, if you propose a God, why in the world would a creature or a being that contained everything within himself, as well as the reason for himself, that had everything, that knew everything, why would he want the universe? Like a bubble for a child to play with? I don't understand that there is necessarily a reason for the universe. We impose reasons because we're people. We think that the things we do and the things we make, we have a reason for doing or making. That's not necessarily so in the case of the universe. When I said that there are libraries full of books and it's like shoveling smoke, I didn't think my worthy opponent was going to bring a library here and start shoveling. But, you know, you can bring books and quote pieces from them and you can use whatever part you want since you're making the selection. He quotes the second law of dynamics, that if it is a closed system, that it would necessarily have run down. The second law of dynamics, of thermodynamics, was proposed about a specific system. And the person who proposed it said, this may not apply if it is not this kind of a closed system. And there's no evidence. Absolute evidence that this universe is a closed system. There is some evidence, and many astronomers think, that it may be a sort of oscillating universe, that it contracts and expands. Now, of course, originally, people knew none of these things. Everything that we know now was unknown at one time. People didn't know what lightning was. When it struck somebody, it obviously seemed like something up there was out to get them. When the ground shook, when volcanoes erupted, it was obvious that something was shaking the ground and blowing smoke and fire and lava up through a mountain. They couldn't conceive of the things that we know now. One of the strongest arguments, or what they think is the strongest arguments against science, is that, after all, science doesn't know everything. Well, that's an interesting argument, that because you don't know everything, you don't know anything. Whereas, if you ask a religionist, why are there millions of children dying of starvation now? Why would a merciful God want to do that? The answer is, well, we don't know God's plan. So that their proof is based on ignorance. Scientists may not know everything, but they claim to know nothing. As far as historical data on Christ, just because somebody says there is historical data that proves it doesn't mean it's necessarily so, that there is a wealth of evidence. I don't know how many of you have read all the pages of all the books of the Bible, first the Old and New Testament, plus all the other material that's around it. It will take a lifetime to do it. I once heard of a rabbi in Europe who had committed to memory 2,300 books of the Old Testament and the exegesis. My opponent is an attorney. I don't know how he would like to face somebody in court who had presented as evidence what he said was a fragment of writing written 5 years within the writing of the Gospel of St. John. I don't know what that says about when John wrote the Gospel, how old he was then, what were the odds of him actually seeing all these things he's writing about. Why do not the Gospels all contain exactly the same words? How would you like to parade witnesses for your side, all of whom told a different story? Now, you know, in those days, there were lots of prophets and holy men wandering around performing miracles. Miracles were a dime a dozen. What kind of miracles were they? The blind could see, a person with a paralyzed arm had it restored to use, a sick man was cured. I must say religious medical science has advanced a great deal in 20 centuries. Because at that time, in order to cure a sick person, the demons, of course, they didn't know about bacteria and amoeba, they had demons that inhabited them, had to be taken out, placed into 2,000 swine, and the swine driven into the sea. That's an interesting story. You'd think, first of all, why not drive the demons directly into the sea? Why couldn't they drown directly? Another sidelight, it seems to me, is in a country where it was forbidden to eat pork. Why anybody would have had a flock of 2,000 pigs? What in the world were they going to do with them? As far as evidence of a virgin having a baby, well, the next time some young lady tells you that she got impregnated on a toilet seat, if you want to believe it, it's okay with me. So I would say that as far as what we have been presented with as evidence is no evidence. We have merely a person's assertion that there is evidence. When it comes down to it, if that evidence was that ironclad, I guarantee you, there would not be a Jew, an atheist, a Muslim, a Buddhist, or anything left in the world. But the evidence is not ironclad, and I urge you all to study as much as you can. But from the standpoint of somebody like a scientist who wants to see the evidence and then see what it means, not as somebody who has made up his mind in advance and is running around looking for bits of evidence to prove that what he believed in the first place was right. Thank you.
It's interesting that the people who write about the events of Jesus' life in the New Testament are people that took a good deal of convincing themselves. After they had spent some 3 years with Jesus, he was crucified and back they were to fishing. Their subsequent careers were based on the facticity of his resurrection. And the people that I've been citing are in general people who began in the same skeptical posture as Mr. Levingston, but who went into great detail to work through this evidence and thereby change their positions. Now, that doesn't mean that that would necessarily happen to you, but it's certainly an incentive for doing that work. One of the reasons that I always cite literature and give a lot of bibliographical citations is just to avoid the problem that Mr. Levingston speaks of, citing out of context. If people want to check out my opinions, they're going to be able to do it. They're going to be able to do it by way of the references that have been given. And it seems to me that that's mighty important. You will not be able to decide a question like this one simply by hearing the two of us talk tonight. The real issue will come afterwards as to whether this has encouraged you to do work on your own to see whether or not this evidence is good or whether it isn't. As a lawyer, I get particularly worried if I have four witnesses get up on the stand and in exactly the same words tell about an accident. Or turning it around, if I'm lucky, that's what the witnesses on the other side will do. And when that happens, ladies and gentlemen, I know that in cross-examination I'm going to destroy them because there has been collusion. One of the best evidences of the reliability of New Testament documents is that you don't have that kind of thing operating. You have different people talking about the same events from different perspectives. This is one of the things that caused Phillips to speak about this as having the ring of truth to it. People like C.S. Lewis, a very fine science fiction writer, as I'm sure that Mr. Levingston knows, one of the things that led C.S. Lewis from atheism to the Christian faith was the prima facie ring of truth in those gospel records presented by people from a Jewish standpoint, from a Hellenistic standpoint, seeing the same kind of phenomena, describing those phenomena from their own standpoint. Miracles were not the dime a dozen. In fact, if you go to Josephus' Antiquities, you'll find that there were other messianic claims about the same time as Jesus. There was one fellow by the name of Thutis who huffed and puffed. He said he was the Messiah. He said he was going to divide the Jordan River. He went down to the Jordan River, and he went to Lo, Kazam, and nothing happened. The result of this was that the Romans came in because of the terrific fuss that had been created, cleaned up the crowd, and cleaned up Thutis. There are a number of instances of this kind of thing, people making claims but simply not being able to pull them off. What you need to do is to check out the specific eyewitness evidence for Jesus' fulfillment of the claims that he made. He put it very directly. He said, tear down this temple, the temple of my body, and in 3 days I'll build it again. He said, there's only one sign that's going to be given to this generation. It's the sign of Jonah. As he was in that beast, so I'll be in the earth, and I will rise again. And the people who didn't believe him before that, when they had contact with that evidence, believed him afterward. It seems to me that the issue is not how many atheists or how many Christians there are per cubic inch. It's not a question of whether everybody would automatically become a Christian if what I'm saying is correct. I've never claimed that. As a matter of fact, there is overwhelming evidence against any racial inferiority on the part of blacks. There is simply overwhelming evidence against the inferior character of blacks or of any particular racial group. Does that mean that there are no more racists? Does that mean that the Kentucky Colonel is no longer trying to put blacks down or stick them at the back of a bus or whatever? The fact of the matter is that belief in God doesn't involve just evidence. It certainly involves evidence, but it doesn't involve only evidence. It finally arrives at the point of an act of will. And one of the hardest things in coming to believe in God is this, that if there is a God, you no longer can be the center of the universe. And that is such an appalling thought that when you look in the mirror in the morning, you are no longer looking at the center of the universe, that it really does deter people from facing this evidence. There's a moral issue involved in this as well as an intellectual issue. And what we need to do is to be willing to face the evidence intellectually and be willing to come to terms with ourselves morally and ethically. Paul Tillich used to say that there really are no atheists because everybody has an ultimate concern. Everybody has something that's more important to him than anything else. Mr. Levingston has something in his life that's more important than anything else. Maybe it's his wife. Maybe it's the opportunity to present what he considers to be the truth. I don't know what it is, but there's something that will last when the chips are down. This is true of everybody. But as Tillich said, the real tragedy is therefore 99.44% of people, their ultimate concerns are not really ultimate. They are less than ultimate. They fall apart. They cloy. They are not worthy of eternal commitment. What it seems to me we've got to do is to check out whether or not God really loved us enough to come to earth and die in Jesus Christ for our sins. If he did, as Dorothy Sayers says, it's the greatest drama in the universe, and it's the sort of thing that can base an ultimate commitment that really is ultimate, and it'll carry you beyond this life into something even more glorious.
Question to each of our speakers, and then we'll open it up to the floor. First of all, for Mr. Livingston, your case seemed to be two-pronged, as I understood it. There was appeal to what's called the problem of evil, the problem of reconciling the existence of a perfectly good and omnipotent God with the fact of evil. And that's, of course, a very deep issue. There are some classic attempts to answer the problem of evil. Obviously, in a short amount of time, we can't go into that in any depth. What I want to ask about is what I saw to be the second basis for your presentation, and that was a recital of various similarities between different world religions. What exactly does that signify for you? One thing that it might entail, one thing that it's compatible with, granting for the moment that you're correct about these various similarities, one could still believe that God exists, but that none of these particular religions happen to get it quite right. There's something suspicious about them. Or perhaps that all these various religions are imperfect manifestations of some single basic truth involving the fact that God exists. Presumably you haven't ended up with either of those opinions. You don't believe that God does exist. Can you tell us a little bit more about what the basis for that belief is?
I think that you struck something when you say that underlying all the religions, there is a common thread. And I think I hit on that when I pointed out how terrifying the world was to those early people who understood nothing. Everything that happened was a mystery. They could control nothing. And to a large extent, religion and belief and faith are an attempt to control the terrible forces that strike us and attack us. Ultimately, we'll all die. That's not a pleasant prospect for those of us who are having a good time here. Nobody wants to go home in the middle of the party. But then there are other things, sudden illness, disaster that strikes for no reason, bad luck, and religion attempts to control those things. Two of the great religions of America, I think you can see that exhibited in those two religions, gambling and sports. If you watch people playing cards, playing slot machines or anything, and watch the motions they go through repeatedly. The fellow who's trying to draw to an inside straight, and he's got four cards, and he draws one, and he's busy shuffling those cards up and back. Now, you know he isn't going to change the spots on the cards, but he's got some belief that sitting in that particular seat where he won last time by shuffling the cards that way is going to influence them. We know it isn't. You watch a baseball pitcher go through the motions that he goes through. It isn't necessary to do all that have to throw the ball and try to get it past the batter. It might be more economical to just go ahead and pitch. But if he has a good game, he may keep wearing that same sweatshirt game after game until his teammates can't get near him as long as he keeps winning. So there are many ways by which we try to influence chance, the fates, whatever you want to call them. One point Dr. Montgomery made, that ultimately we come down to something that is really, in other words, faith. That's what it amounts to. You have to have faith. Otherwise, as some man once tried to explain to me when I was very young, he said, he asked me if I believed in God, and I said, no. And he said, well, you have to have faith. I said, sorry, how do I get faith? He said, you read the Bible. I said, I've read the Bible. I don't believe it. He said, that's because you don't have faith. So there we go. As far as ultimate concerns and other concerns, I don't see the point of that. It isn't necessary for me to have an ultimate concern. I could spend a lifetime just trying to help right some of the wrongs that I see around me. So beyond that, I'm not going to worry. If you want to, that's okay.